When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Farmers Guardian is proud to work alongside the Rock and Roll Farming Podcast. For all the latest news and features from across the ag industry, head to fginsight.com. You'll also find a wide variety of advice pieces to help you and your farming business flourish.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Rock and Roll Farming is proud to be part of the Farm and Rural Ag Network. For more great agriculture-related podcasts and vlogs, please visit farmruralag.com.
Farm Africa!
Oye!
Uganda!
Oye!
Kanungu!
Oye!
Youth!
Oye!
Women!
Oye!
Coffee!
Oye!
UK!
Oye!
What you've just heard is the reaction of farmers in Kanunga, Uganda, to hearing that Farm Africa's Coffee is Life appeal has launched. Between 8th of February and 8th of May, donations in support of my London Marathon Challenge will go to Farm Africa's Coffee is Life appeal. If you can donate before 8th of May 2019, all public donations to Farm Africa's Coffee is Life appeal will be doubled by the UK government. What a country. Your donation will support Farm Africa projects across Eastern Africa, and the matched funding you unlock from the UK government will directly fund a Farm Africa project that will give women in Kanungu in Western Uganda the opportunity to make a decent living from coffee farming. I'm trying to raise £5,000 to support the appeal, and if you could spare anything at all, we would greatly appreciate it. Just visit justgiving.com/fundraising/William-Evans12, and I will put that link in the show notes. Thank you. Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 113. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I'm heading across the country to Norfolk to talk to farmer and former TV presenter Jeremy Buxton. Jeremy, how are you?
Will, I'm fine, thank you. Nice to be speaking with you.
You too. So tell us about Norfolk and the area where you live.
Well, Norfolk, for those that don't know, is incredibly flat, Will. It's probably radically different to where you're from.
Yeah.
We actually farm pretty much in the centre of Norfolk, actually. We're about half an hour from the lovely North Norfolk coast, mm-hmm. Half an hour from the Norfolk Broads, which I guess a lot of people have heard of,
yeah.
And then equally about 20 minutes from the fine city of Norwich. So, yeah, just farming on our small family farm in the heart of Norfolk.
And that would be mostly arable farms around that part of the world.
Yeah, it is. It is all pretty much all cereals, a lot of sugar beet, a lot of rape. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a few livestock farms around here and a bit of mixed farming, you know, not many dairy farms at all. You know, dairy farms over the last few years have just, you know, not totally disappeared, but there aren't as many as there were, say, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 years ago or something.
Yeah, I suppose that's the same everywhere, really, isn't it, sadly?
Yeah.
So how long have the family been farming there?
Okay, so my grandfather bought the farm that we currently farm, my parents and I, in the early 60s. But my grandfather was sort of like quite a big farmer. He amassed quite a lot of land and then split it up between my father and his two brothers. And then before that they were farming, and I think his grandfather was a gamekeeper. So my family, they've always worked on the land, basically.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to be a farmer growing up or not?
I guess like most kids growing up on a farm, you know, you follow your dad about and you kind of do with him. I really did, and you know, I was always out with him. I just remember driving around him in the sort of pickup truck with a dog on the back, and really enjoyed it. And you know, so much so when I was like 13, I had my own flock of sheep and everything, and I was really into it. And then it, you know, life sometimes just takes you in different directions.
Yeah. So how old are you? About my age, are you about early 40s?
Yeah, I'm 42. I always get this wrong. I'm 43. Let's say
43. Okay. So yeah, we're not far off. So we're not far off. So I mean, I guess growing up sort of through the 90s, it wasn't the most encouraging time to go into farming either, was it?
Well, that's it, exactly. And I just, you know, there was so much doom and gloom about it. My parents were so sort of, oh, you do not want to be doing this, you know. This is, and my mum in particular, she was really sort of, she wasn't from a farming family, so she really pushed the sort of, you know, get an education. So, you know, with both me and my two sisters, she was, you know, GCSEs, A-levels, university, get that behind you and then make some decisions.
Yeah, so how did you end up studying French then?
Just, it's strange, from a young age, I was a bit of a francophile, I think.
Really?
It all started with my school French exchange trips. We had a brilliant French teacher at school, and she just sort of made learning French great fun. So then it just sort of took off from there. We went on French exchanges, you know, you kind of fell in love with a French girl on the French exchange. But, you know, and it all just sort of blossomed from there, really. And then I just carried on from GCSE to A-level, and then into university. I did international business with modern languages.
Yeah. So do you still speak fluent French now?
I don't know. it sounds funny, but obviously in Norfolk, there's not many French people kicking around. But, you know, sometimes I will just be like going up and down the field talking to myself in French. You know, just, people just think I'm mad. If anyone heard me, they just think, who's this crazy French dude? But I occasionally speak to friends in France. Once you've learned a language to the point where you're fluent, I don't think you ever really lose it. You might get a bit rusty, but, you know, as soon as you're back in conversation, it just kicks in, basically.
Yeah, because you ended up living in Paris for a number of years, right?
Yeah, exactly. I lived there for 12 years, from 2000 to 2012.
That is, I mean, what's it like living in Paris? It's very different to Norfolk, I guess, and where I live. I mean, you know, one of the sort of perceived coolest places you could ever live. What was I doing?
Someone who's so uncool. What was I doing in Paris? I don't know. But it was amazing. It was just one of the best times of my life.
Yeah.
It was, you know, you can imagine, I was fresh out of university. I walked into a job. I had cash in my pocket. I met some really great friends. You know, we had a riot. I mean, we had a great time in Paris.
Oh, but and so many great restaurants and places to eat there.
Well, this is it. And I am a total foodie. I mean, I absolutely love my food. Yeah. I've got a real soft spot for French cuisine as well. I mean, the food was amazing. And it's one of those things, Paris is, that people think it's a really expensive place to go and visit. But that's, you know, if you get off the beaten track, there are just so many amazing cafes and restaurants. And, you know, we got to know some great places to the point where we knew the staff. And it was just, you know, Parisians get a hard sort of like, rap sometimes for being quite stern and quite unfriendly, but I mean, it's not the case at all. You know, I think that's just the tourist sort of perception of them. If you get there and get under their skin and sort of live there and live with them and speak their language, you know, they're great. You know, they're just like us, really. They're great people. You know, they've got their own idiosyncrasies, which is just hilarious. You know, they can't park cars.
Yeah,
you know, and things like that, and you know, they're probably more, you know, as you go south through Europe, people do get more sort of emotive and emotional and whatever. They're great people, you know. I've got some great friends in Paris.
Yeah, no, I've been to Paris a few times. We actually went for our honeymoon to Paris, me and my wife. So yeah, it's great place. Well, it's an awesome place just to walk around, isn't it?
It's such a manageable city because it's such a good size. You can sort of walk the city in no time, and it's just sort of and like you said, the architecture is beautiful. It's just a stunning city, you know, and every day it will turn up something new for you. Even, you know, I was there for 12 years, and every day or every week or something, I discover something that I hadn't seen before. It's a great place.
Yeah, fantastic. So how did you find yourself working in TV? How did that come about?
The biggest stroke of luck ever. I mean, it wasn't by design at all. You know, it was just, it's one of these things where I was in the right place at the right time. You know, because I, as I said, I did my GCSEs, then I did my A levels, and I was one of these people. I had no real sort of idea of what I really wanted to do. So yeah. All my studies were just kind of quite generic and left a lot of doors open for me. So I just sort of business studies and languages. I just thought that would be something that, you know, could lead to a lot of potentially different jobs, basically.
Yeah.
And so whilst I was at university in Plymouth, we had to do a third year sort of work experience. And me and some mates, I mean, we weren't even worried about what we were doing. We just knew that we wanted to go and live in Paris for a year. So the job was just a totally second consideration, basically. So we got ourselves the accommodation and everything sorted in Paris. And then, you know, we had to get on and find ourselves a job. And I wound up in this just really corporate environment, big office, big multinational business. And it just wasn't working for me at all. Just going into work suited and booted every day. I quickly got the idea that, you know, that wasn't what I was going to be doing with my life. So after about a week or so, I said, listen, guys, I'm not coming back tomorrow. This isn't for me.
After a week?
Yeah. I didn't give it a lot of time, but you know.
Well, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
And so then I was, you know, I was in a bit of a mess then, because I had to get my credits for university. I still had to complete a year's work experience. So I just sort of, for a few weeks, I was just doing like telesales and things. And then I was keeping my eyes open for more work experience. And I've always loved sport. I've always played loads of sport, and I've always loved watching sport. And so when I found out the headquarters for Eurosport was in Paris, I was, well, I've got to apply for some work experience there. So I did. And fortunately, they took me on for about 10 months work experience. And it was just amazing. It was the best 10-month work experience you could ever dream of. The people were great. The opportunities that I was given, even as I was expecting to sort of make tea and coffee. But by the end of it, I was going out to Geneva to interview the president of UEFA and things like that. And,
jeez.
I know. It was crazy. Why would they trust a loon like me to do that? I don't. I managed it and I did it. And it's kind of, so that kind of focused my sort of attention towards television. And and actually, before I left, they actually offered me a job to stay with them, because again, I don't know why, but it, I mean, the whole experience went really well for me and for them, and it just seemed like a natural thing that I would be working for Eurosport.
Yeah.
So they offered me a job, and then I said, listen, I should really go back and finish my degree. Although, I mean, that was the last thing that I wanted to do, but it just seemed a bit, you know, outboard. Yeah. Really, for my parents, they paid for me to go to university and sort of sorted me out to turn around and say, right, I'm just going to stay here in Paris.
Right.
So I went back, begrudgingly, I went back to Plymouth and finished my final year. Although I say I finished it, actually, Eurosport phoned up about 3 weeks before my finals and said, we're launching a new channel. Would you like to be a part of that? And of course, I bit their arm off. Yeah. I'm totally there. So I, even before my finals, I'd organized my job, my dream job with Eurosport in Paris. And I kind of, I'm whispering because I don't want my parents to know. I kind of didn't go to a lot of my finals, basically. You know, you could find me on the beaches of Devon and Cornwall whilst my peers were doing their final exams at university. but the thing, my logic was that, you know, you go to university to get a job, and I had it, and it was my dream job. And I'm one of these people that just hates exams. I just can't stand them. I just turn into this wreck. So I thought, why am I going to put myself through that when I've got this job?
Yeah. Wow.
So, rightly or wrongly, I didn't sit many of my final exams. But then a few weeks later, got on a bus and headed out to Paris, and, you know, was just so happy to be there.
Yeah. So, I mean, you sent me a video compilation of some of the amazing things you did. I mean, talk us through your career. I mean, you did some unbelievable things.
Yeah, well, it didn't start off like the things that you saw in the video immediately. That was after a period of time. But I arrived for the launch of a new channel. I was literally, you know, the bottom of the ladder. You know, I was the guy who was doing the infographics, typing it to come up on screen. And I was I've always been quite sort of ambitious. And I just, after a few sort of months, I just said to my boss that, you know, okay, I've got this. What can I do next? You know, and I was always banging on his door saying, look, this is great, but what can I do? You know, I really want to get out there and have more of a input into the production of the television programs and actually be on site at the events as well. So I sort of quite quickly made my way through the company from online editor to editor, actually editing the news stories, to cameraman. I was a cameraman for a long while. And then I was a producer, sort of producing sort of programs and news programs. But I'd always sort of in the back of my head said, I'm never going to be a presenter because, I don't know, I just didn't like the idea of being in front of a camera.
Yeah.
And shied away from it. But then one day someone just said, look, do you want to do this? And I thought, well, you know, in for a penny, in for a pound, I'll give it a whirl.
Yeah.
Because Eurosport's a funny company as well. They're just sort of, as most people know, they're quite tight on resources. So if you were English in the Paris office and they needed an English presenter, you know, you'd probably get the call at some point. It wasn't through qualification or a particular talent for doing it. It was just in the right place at the right time.
And did it come naturally? Because presenting to camera is, I think, much harder than people would think it is, isn't it?
It didn't come naturally at all. It was total torture. I mean, I was a very, very average or below average presenter. I mean, I think if it wasn't for Eurosport, I would never have made it on screen, I don't think. You know, it was just, I think speaking to some people, I was just trying to be myself, you know, just sort of, and try to get that across. And that, because the premise of the programs that I was making were documentaries, spending time with athletes and sports teams, and trying to show the viewer what it was like if you took a man from the street and put them in that sort of professional situation to train and play with them so that they could understand what it was like to be an elite athlete, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. So what were the kind of things you were doing?
As anyone who's watched Eurosport knows, I mean, it's just a complete mad mix of sports. You know, from the mainstream sports, you know, football, rugby, through sort of cycling, because, of course, it's heavily influenced what, you know, viewers want to watch on in mainland Europe.
Yeah.
And winter sports were really big for Eurosport, as was tennis. So I got involved with all sorts of things, you know, from ice hockey to American football to skateboarding with Tony Hawk to rugby with the All Blacks in New Zealand, boxing with Ricky Hatton. You know, just I pretty much had a go at all sports, basically.
Jeez. What was the most challenging sport? What did you find the hardest?
For someone in their mid 30s trying to learn to skateboard, I don't recommend it. That was so tough.
And I can imagine.
You know, and I'm definitely not meant to be on a skateboard. Total arse myself. You know, in front of people like in Los Angeles with Tony Hawk at his house. Just sort of like going arse over tit. And I dislocated both my shoulders on that program.
Jeez.
Yeah. Face planting off a skateboard. So that was tough. And then, but in terms of like physical exertion, and I was most impressed was we made a boxing documentary.
Yeah.
In Manchester. And we visited this gym. That was basically trying to get kids off the street, you know, out of gangs and into gyms and turning them, you know, into amateur at least and possibly professional boxers. And I went in there and it just opened my eyes up to the sport and just how physically demanding it is. It was just absolutely, because I immersed myself in their training regimes. And so in the morning went in and we did gym work. And then in the afternoon they'd go out and do, I don't know, a massive run or something, or some sort of cardio stuff.
Yeah.
And then do more sparring in the evening. And, you know, in between sort of training, they'd go off to work or something. And I'd have to go back to our hotel and have a sleep. I mean, that was amazing. Boxing is a tough sport. There's no doubt about it.
Oh, fair. And I mean, what was the best thing about it? I mean, you must have met some amazing people. And I don't just mean the sort of the famous sports people. I mean, the kind of people like that you met in the boxing gym.
Yeah, exactly. Just really sort of some great characters. Like, yeah. For example, my trainer in that boxing program was just a phenomenal guy with a heart of gold. You know, mm-hmm. He wanted to get kids off the street, away from gangs, and he just dedicated all of his time to doing that. But then at the other end of the scale, you do have these incredible professional athletes who are so dedicated and so focused. It's just amazing and a real privilege to be around. You know, it's sort of, I mean, I've got so many stories. It's like I met Chris Gayle in Bangalore.
You sent me the picture before. I'm a big cricket fan, so I was so excited about that.
Well, likewise, I'm a massive cricket fan.
Yeah. And
we were making a documentary on the Champions League in India, and we were following the Bangalore Challengers, and of course Chris Gayle at the time was playing for them, along with, you know, Daniel Vittori and Virat Kohli, and to be able to hang out with all of these guys and you know, chuck a ball around with them and watch them in the nets and go to the games they're playing. And we had to, for the documentary, we had to get an interview, obviously, with this legendary batsman, Chris Gayle. I did the interview with Chris Gayle, and I can't believe it seems so long ago now. And he said to me after the interview, you know, do you want to come back to the hotel for a drink? And I was like, what? I was like, yeah. I do, you know, cricket and beer, you know, what's better?
Yeah.
So I went back to the hotel and he came down to the bar and he just explained that because he is so well known and he literally cannot leave his hotel.
Yeah.
So he was during these sort of like IPL and Champions League tournaments, he just gets so lonely, he was telling me. And any sort of company, even some nutter from Norfolk, you know, is better than sitting in his bedroom just, you know, playing computer games and stuff. So for a few days, I was Chris Gayle's drinking buddy.
That's incredible. So have you got, like, loads of pictures on your office wall of you with the various sporting superstars?
I keep meaning to do that. I've got all of these great pictures and, you know, which bring back such fond memories, and I've got to do that actually, because you easily forget, and I need to sort of, and I want my family, you know, my children to see it as well, and so I've got to organise something like that.
Cool. So when did you start to tire of that life?
It was sort of as the presenting sort of you know, time passed and everything. It was a lot of time living out of a suitcase.
Yeah.
Literally flying, spending a lot of time in airports and hotels. And so from a work point of view, I mean, it was great. I mean, I was having the best time. Uh-huh. But back in Paris, a lot of my friends were leaving because I had a lot of international friends, a lot of people from the UK. And Paris is a very sort of transient city. So people don't really come there and stay for long periods of time. They sort of come and go and come and go. Mm-hmm. So a lot of my friends left. So when I was in Paris, it was kind of, I found myself on my own quite a lot. Mm-hmm. When I wasn't in work. And that sort of was kind of, right, this is the time to go now, because, you know, this is, the work's good. You know, you leave now, you're on a real high. And also within the work environment, I didn't feel like I could go any further and enjoy it as much. I felt like I'd done everything that I wanted to do. You know, beyond that, it would be some sort of desk job. So I sort of decided that I would, and I'd always planned to come back to England as well, but I decided sort of after the Olympics in 2012 that I'd come back to the UK. And my plan was to continue as a freelance presenter in England, but it's a totally different market here. So for a very average TV presenter coming over to back to London with some great talent about, you know, I quickly realised that, you know, it was going to be tough to find work.
So how did you end up back on the family farm?
Well, so I came back to Norfolk after I left Paris, and because I didn't have anywhere else to go, really. Mm-hmm. I came back to my mum and dad's, and spent a bit of time researching the whole sort of freelance presenting thing, and you know, just going from Norfolk to London to auditions and whatnot on the train. And I soon worked out that, you know, it wasn't going to be the same as I knew it in Paris. You know, mm-hmm. It was very different. And during that time, I was sort of helping on the farm, helping Dad out during harvest and stuff. And mm-hmm. I just kind of picked up the bug for it then, really. It was just sort of, it was so different, and it was so sort of, I took a great deal of satisfaction in, you know, when you're farming, you know, you get instant sort of satisfaction, you know,
yeah.
Cultivating a field or something, you go in at the beginning of the day, and at the end of the day, you can see what you've achieved.
Mm.
And I really enjoyed that. So that was, and I mean, much to my parents' utter shock and horror. You know what? I think I'm going to have a go at this, if that's all right with you guys. So that's pretty much how it happened, really. I just sort of, you know, I got the bug, and I loved being back in Norfolk, you know, and I'm a country boy at heart. You know, even when I was living in Paris, I took such great comfort in getting out into the countryside in France, and also coming back to the family farm. It was real sort of restorative. It was just good for me, you know, and
yeah.
So I just love being back in Norfolk.
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken to quite a few people for the podcast who've gone away but felt that draw back to the family farm later in life. I guess if you're a farm kid, it's just always in you, isn't it? Wherever you are.
Yeah, I definitely believe that. Actually. I really do. It's sort of somewhere in your blood or something.
Mm.
Because, and obviously you've got such amazing childhood memories.
Yeah.
Just, you know, to recreate that in some way, shape or form, at an older age and whatever. I mean, hell of a lot more stressful than back then. But, you
know. Yeah. So, no,
it's great.
So when you came home, did you have a clear idea of what you wanted to do? Did you just want to join the business as it was, or did you want to make some changes? How did you go about it?
Well, it was an interesting time because, you know, my mum and dad had done a brilliant job running the farm. And done really well, and you know, in the heyday did really well, but you know, survived, you know, some tough times as well, you know. Mm-hmm. Small farms, you know, there were some tough times.
Sure.
And they managed to get through them, and at the same time look after three kids and support and help them. So, you know, I just wanted to work on the farm and just for a year or so just sort of find my feet. Well,
yeah.
That was my thing. I quickly sort of wanted to, I had plans, you know, I've always been ambitious, and I wanted to get on and crack on. And so as Dad was winding the farm down to sort of into retirement, and I wanted to wind it up as quick as I could. has been an interesting journey, a tough journey, you know. I mean, as anyone in family farming knows, it's tough working with your family. It's really sort of I've found that, you know, one of the challenges, working in such proximity with my parents, having lived mm-hmm. away abroad for 12 years.
Yeah.
Coming back and working in this business. And they've been brilliant. I mean, they've supported me in what I wanted to do. But because one of my priorities was that I didn't want to see the farm leave the family. You know, it'd been in the family for so long.
Yeah.
Someone to take it on. And I felt my sisters both worked away and were never going to do that. So I just sort of, I didn't feel an obligation, but, you know, sentimentality was a part of me wanting to do it as well, basically.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that about families, working with families. It is a challenge, isn't it? As much as you love them, it's not always easy, is it?
Yeah, exactly. Especially when, you know, you've got three different characters,
yeah.
People who have had different life experiences, mm-hmm. and,
you know, different. It's so tough, but you know, you make it work, and you know, and for the large part, I think it has worked here.
Yeah.
I mean, we've had some absolutely stonking arguments, and you know, whatever. You know, I'd be surprised if there was a family farm that, you know, didn't have arguments.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So you early on realised the importance of diversification. You wanted to move away from producing commodity crops, right?
Well, it was just, it's more need and necessity, you know, as a small family farm, basically, to survive in the current economic climate and the way things are going. I just figured... Basically, I had one of the first things I did when I came back to the farm was I went to the Oxford Real Farming Conference.
Yeah.
And someone suggested I should go, probably because, you know, I was pretty green, you know, when I came back. I didn't know an awful lot about what I was doing. So I went down there and just listened to some really interesting lectures.
Yeah.
And that kind of shaped the direction that I wanted to go in terms of my sort of philosophy, but also the direction that I felt was the right way for us to go as a business, you know, because when I came back just an hour, we were contracting, you know, most of the work out to a contractor. So there were some changes that I could see needed to be made if we were going to make a go of it. So diversification was a big part of that, but also how we manage the farm work itself. And I wanted to bring livestock back onto the farm because we had a lot of permanent pasture that wasn't really being used to its full potential. So I just thought, you know, that's something else that I could change possibly for the better. And I think, you know, our farm, we're only, 20 acres. It's not great soil here. It's sort of like, you know, in a field, one end it can be really light land, the other end can be really heavy land. So it's, you know, it's a juggling act getting that.
Yeah.
So, mixed farming was the way that I wanted to go, and then also keep an eye on diversification and seeing what projects that we could work on to bring in more revenue, basically.
Yeah. Okay. So you decided to reintroduce cattle. You went with Herefords.
Yeah, I did. And that, again, was just sort of, you know, I said that I wanted to introduce livestock. And firstly, I was thinking about sheep, but everyone kept advising me that sheep just either want to escape or kill them. So I was kind of like, well, that doesn't sound great. So my father was had a lot of cattle during his sort of heyday as a farmer. During his lifetime, he had a suckler herd and really enjoyed working with cattle. So I knew that I'd always have, you know, this source of advice and knowledge that was there if we went into cattle, basically.
Mm-hmm.
He's a great stockman, so that sort of helped my decision to go into cattle. And then the reason we chose Herefords was basically because I knew that I'd be doing a lot of the work on my own, so I wanted something that was easy to handle, you know, good temperament.
Yeah.
And I just like the idea of a native breed as well, and I wanted to sort of produce animals that were sort of, you know, would do well on a mainly forage diet, basically. So that was the thinking with the Herefords. Just, and of course, I just think they look great as well, to be honest with you. Herefords on lush green grass. I mean, there's no better picture, is there? I mean, I think they look fantastic.
They do. Yeah.
I think native breeds are becoming more popular and, you know, sort of, I'll probably get shot down by some farmers for saying that, but I do. That's my own opinion.
No, I think you're quite right. I mean, you can see that, can't you? Just in the farming press, you can see that many breeds are making a bit of a comeback, can't you? But no, I like seeing Herefords out in the field as well. They look fantastic, as you say.
Yeah, exactly. And I just think that you know, native breeds are just sort of, they're native for a reason, you know, because they do well in our climate with the environment that they're bred and raised upon, and they're predominantly cheap to feed through the winter. Dry cows, you know, they don't need as much TLC and grub as the continentals. So again, I'm probably going to get shot down for that. But this is just what I think, basically. But yeah, I'm a big fan of Hereford. So we went for the Herefords, and so far, so good. But again, we had another stroke of luck, is that someone was having a herd dispersal in Northampton, and someone gave us the tip off, and we went and bought most of their herd, and they were great cattle, and that was just a great foundation to start with. And then, you know, people within the Hereford sort of community have been really good and kind and generous with their advice for me. So yeah, it's been a really fun and an enjoyable journey with the cattle.
Fantastic. So one of the other ways you've diversified is into agritourism.
Yes. Yeah. It's something that my parents talked about for ages. You know, even when I was in Paris, they were like, we're gonna open a campsite. We're going to do it. You know? And it never really materialized. And I just felt, you know, we had some space where we could do that. And so I just went for it, you know, again, blindly went into running a campsite. Didn't know what I was doing, but just put aside some land, put it down to grass, put some electric hookups in, put a toilet and shower in, and there you go, we've got a campsite, and we've been running it for about 3 years now, and year on year it seems to be growing nicely, and yeah, it's doing all right, and I'm hoping we can expand on it.
Yeah, was that a big decision? Because I always think it must be, because one of the nice things about living on a farm is there's not many people around, so it can be an escape. When you've suddenly got paying guests there, that's obviously a big difference.
It is, and you know, if you saw our farm, the campsite, me and my wife have just moved into a new build farmhouse, and the campsite is probably about 10 meters from where, 10, 20 meters from where I'm sitting. So my wife just made me erect this massive Trump-style wall between us and the campsite, just to give them privacy from us and vice versa. So, you know, but it's strange, you know, because it's an adult-only site, and, you know, they're as good as gold. They're just sort of... They come in, do their thing, and then they go off and explore Norfolk. And we don't really have any trouble with them at all. And I really enjoy meeting people. You know, it's just nice to go out. Like you said, farms are sort of like there's not many people about.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm kind of a people's person.
Yeah.
So I like going and speaking to them. And that's something I've also tried to do since I'm back on the farm, is make sure there's plenty of life on the farm and people about. Because I just think that's good for me to have, you know, not be too isolated.
Yeah. I mean, you obviously need people skills, which I guess you have from your previous career of working with so many different people for so long.
Yeah. Yeah. I suppose so. It's just, I just like a chat, Will, you know, I to chat to anyone. But I also, the thing about the camping is that I really enjoy having people on the farm and talking to them about farming and possibly educating them about, you know, what it is we're doing and how we're doing it. Because I feel that's something that's really important to me, is getting farming out there to the general public and educating them. And, you know, because farming gets a lot of bad press, and I think the more we do,
yeah,
to change direction on that, the better. So if I can speak to some campers and just show them that, you know, farming is not such a bad thing, and this is how we produce our crops, and these are our cattle, and it's nice to see people just sort of, you know, thinking about it and going away with a different idea about farming, really.
Yeah, and you're now selling your Hereford cattle through a beef box scheme. Do many of the campers many of them buy the beef, and do you get good results from that?
Do you know, I haven't sold a single piece of beef to a single camper, actually. but that's not because I don't know why that is, actually, but the thing is, the beef box thing, I think it's because we sell out the beef boxes so quickly. It's something I started a few years ago, and it's just trying to add value, isn't it?
Yeah.
I much prefer selling to the local community than just our beef going to some generic meat dealership or whatever, and going and finding its way into supermarket, yeah, and nobody knowing anything about it. Whereas, you know, it's good for the local community, because obviously they know where it's coming from. They see our cattle out in the pastures grazing. And we do really well out of it. It's just, we're lucky enough to have an abattoir just 10 minutes down the road. So we just run them up there first thing in the morning. I mean, nobody likes an abattoir, so I just want my animals in there, killed first, as little stress as possible. Then they're sent to local butchers that we use, who cut it all up for us into 10-kilo boxes, and then we sell that to the local community. And it's I've been surprised with how well it's gone, actually. It's, you know, with a bit of social media advertising and a bit of word of mouth, you know, we're now at the point where, you know, it's 24 hours after we've advertised it, we sold a whole carcass.
Wow.
You know, and from an animal, we're generally taking in animals when they're about 16 or 17 months old. They're about 420 kilos hanging up on a hook. And so we get about 20 boxes out of them, and £100 a box. You know, you don't have to be a genius. It, you know, it works very well. You know, financial figures stack up. You know, we're clearing about $2,000 after costs.
Yeah.
It's great. And I just get a great sense of satisfaction and pride when, you know, you're delivering your own product to someone's doorstep, and you can tell them about it, and then they come back and buy some more, which is just a great feeling.
Yeah. So have you got plans to expand? There's clearly scope to that.
Yeah, I think there's still a lot of potential around where we live here.
Yeah.
You know, we haven't even scratched the surface. I think with more marketing, and we could do a lot more around here. But I've recently just a couple of people who've set up a food distribution business here in Norfolk. They want to take good, you know, food from the countryside into London.
Mm-hmm.
And they've approached me and want to take our Hereford beef down to London, which is great. And
that's fantastic.
I've just taken on another 140 acres of grassland and to set up a commercial herd. So it's comforting knowing that we've already got a potential market.
Yeah.
And we can sort of work back from there, and just sort of, you know, sometimes when you start a project, you're a bit freaked out by it all. And
absolutely.
So knowing that we may have a potential outlet in London is good news, you know.
Jeez, yeah, that's really exciting. And also, in more exciting news, you've also applied for planning permission for a farm shop and cafe next to your new house.
Yeah, exactly. You can imagine.
Bring even more people to the house.
I know. It's crazy. But the thing is, when I came back, it was sort of I rented a cottage on the neighbouring farm, and you know, that was great for a short term plan. But you know, I needed to be, you know, I'm having to drive up the road during calving and everything, so I needed to be living on the farm. So we set about getting planning permission to build a new farmhouse on the farm, and it was a lot tougher than I ever imagined. I thought, if you own land, then surely you can build on it. But it wasn't that easy. We got a lot of objections. And the reason that we got the planning permission eventually was because we said that we were going to have a campsite here. We were going to have a farm shop and a tea room. So someone needed to be on site. And there was this whole, you know, massive amount of diversification going on that justified someone having a new house. So that's another reason, you know, that pushed the diversification even quicker than I originally anticipated it happening. I mean, you know, we've done so much in a short period of time. I mean, it's exhausting, but we're getting
So when do you hope to open with a farm shop cafe?
It's one of those things that we now have planning permission, so that's there. I don't, you know, you've got to earn some cash before you start spending. So I just want to consolidate a bit.
Yeah.
I definitely want to do it, but I feel in the last few months, I've just been going a bit too quick and a bit too hard at things. I just want to ease off a bit.
Yeah.
Consolidate what we've got and just give myself a bit of a break and my family a bit of a break as well, because we've been going hell for leather.
Mm-hmm.
think we've got to be kind to ourselves sometimes.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, you mentioned isolation and how that wasn't good for you before. Everything we've talked about so far has been very, very, very positive. But like everybody, there is some negatives. You have had your struggles with mental health.
Yeah. It's I know. And the strange thing, when people meet me, if I choose to tell them that, then I think they're massively surprised.
I'm
a really upbeat, very positive, very ambitious, very outgoing sort of person. But I think that's the thing with mental health. It can creep up on anyone.
Yeah.
And it can completely come out of the blue and just tap you on the shoulder and just say, look, you know, and bring you back down to earth with a massive bump. And, mm-hmm. You know, my family's been touched a lot by mental health issues from, the things going on when we were kids that sort of affected us all quite deeply and probably had a long-lasting effect on us. And then when I was in Paris, I mentioned it earlier, there was a period when all my friends were moving away and I was traveling a lot and I was working hard. I was just working a lot. You know, that's what I always do. If I throw myself into my work.
Yeah.
Together and, you know, stop sort of, I don't know, thinking about myself. And if I've got any issues, then I'll turn to work. And,
yeah.
You know, just to keep my mind busy, just to keep my busy, just to sort of, you know, just to stop any sort of bad thoughts or demons, you know. Sometimes it works and you keep everything under control, but you know, if you go too far down that road, then things can get on top of you. And I did myself in a pretty nasty place where I was just sort of became isolated, but then isolated myself even more. And for a period of time it was just a really dark, lonely, sad place, and I just I wouldn't leave my flat. If I wasn't working, I would just stay in my flat basically, and I would just which was just so unlike me. You know, I'm such a sociable person, enjoys playing sports and everything, and I would just stay at home and just do nothing, and I'd have no energy. I just couldn't get out of bed. It was just it's really tough times, and it just sort of all came to a head, you know, where I realized something, and I just speak to a friend of mine, and I just broke down in tears, just going, I don't know what's wrong with me. And he actually pointed out, look, you've got really serious depression here, you know, there's a mental health issue going on here.
Yeah.
And sort of pointed me in the direction of a counselor, and so I sort of started seeing a counsellor for about a year, and you know, they were just dark times. And even the counselling, be careful, because you've got to get that right as well, because that sort of opened up a whole can of worms as well. So it wasn't a quick fix. There was a lot of soul searching, and you know, talking about things that I didn't really want to be talking about.
Yeah,
it was tough, and it kind of you know, and whilst all of that was going on, I was having to go off and, you know, put on a brave face and then TV program.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. That must have been difficult, almost living two different lives, I guess.
Well, totally. It was just like a Herculean effort.
To
get myself out of my flat and get on a plane and go somewhere and just, you know, raise the enthusiasm and the interest, and it's I don't have many regrets in life, but I do regret that it all got on top of me, because I was doing some of the amazing things, and sometimes I couldn't even enjoy them as much as I probably should have done, just because I was just having these issues with with my head and everything, and my mental health, and it's tough. But you know, fortunately, you know, I've got a great family and great friends, and my friends were amazing, because once I eventually sort of let it out of the bag that I was struggling, they just rallied around and were just, you know, amazing.
Yeah.
My sister, who lives in Berlin, was, you know, she just sent over, you know, loads of cash, because, you know, I spiraled into, you know, drinking a lot, and it was was just, you know, Paris, you know, was great, and it was quite a party town, but it, you know, that could work against you, you know.
I'm sure, yeah.
Quite a hedonistic lifestyle, it can quickly
get
worse, and you know, you're doing things that you don't want to be doing, just to, and doing crazy things, and you know, so that was my first brush with mental health issues. And I managed to get back on track before I left Paris, you know.
Yeah, is it something? Yeah, you mentioned it. The family, there's been one or two issues. Is that something that you talk about as a family? Can you talk about it or not?
Not really. And, you know, I mean,
yeah,
we're, I love my family dearly, but we're a funny bunch, you know. We're not great communicators.
But I think that's very common with farming families, isn't it? That's why I ask. I mean, I would say my family are the same, exactly the same.
Yeah, exactly. So we're not great communicators. Yeah. And that doesn't help if you do have mental issues. The best thing that you can do is talk about it and get out there and not suffer on your own. Whereas, you know, I didn't feel I could talk to about it. And you know, stupidly, I didn't want to burden my parents with it. I didn't want them to worry about me. I didn't want them to, you know, I wanted them to see me as this, you know, bright, outgoing, successful guy, and you know, and this, and that's what I wanted everyone to see. You know, I didn't want anyone to see this sort of, you know, at the time I felt, you know, pretty weak and a bit sort of, you know, I don't know. You know, you just lose all your confidence, so you don't feel great about yourself.
Yeah.
So you know, you are conscious of what people will think about you if you do tell them.
Mm.
So it's a bit of a vicious circle, really, and it's. It's a struggle, you know, to get back on track because of those reasons.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's well documented the farming industry has a problem with mental health and suicide. Why do you think this is the case?
I think it's because of the pressure of the job.
Yeah.
I worked 12 years in the media industry where it was, you know, phenomenal amount of pressure. You know when you're on live programs, you're working to a clock and seconds, and there's, you know, lots can go wrong. That's pressure. But, you know, farming is exactly the same. You know, there's different pressures. It's a high pressure job. And a lot of people don't understand that, you know, it's, decisions can make or break farms and farming.
Definitely, yeah.
So there's that constant pressure that's always there. And then, like we've mentioned, you know, it's a very lonely job as well. And you spend a lot of time isolated. You know, you can spend a whole day and days on, day after day, not talking to many people. And you know, for us human beings, that's not really a natural situation. You know, we're meant to be around other people. We're meant to talk. We're meant to share our problems. And so, you know, I think those are a couple of really important issues that face farmers and that can lead to mental health issues, and those pressures lead to people just working so hard,
yeah,
and therefore forgetting about what they need, you know, the creature comforts, being kind to themselves, you know? Mm-hmm. I often talk about, you know, you've got to be kind to yourself, you've got to give yourself some time off, you've got to get away from the farm, you've got to do things that you enjoy. Because otherwise you just get caught up on this hamster wheel of, you know, it's day in, day out, the same thing. And, you know, last year, it happened to me again. I just got caught up too much in my work and everything. And I think I just got really tired after, you know, we'd had a child and I wasn't sleeping. Me and my wife weren't sleeping.
Damn kids.
Blame the kids. Driving up the wall. No, but my son Edward is the best thing in my world.
Yeah,
and he was an absolutely instrumental part of getting me back on track again.
But
you know, it's just a culmination of lots of things, you know, for farmers that, you know.
Yeah.
This is why we need to talk about it more, not only for people within the industry, but for people outside of the industry to understand what it is to be a farmer and the challenges that we face. It's not just the financial challenges. It's not just you know, there are so many more challenges that we have to face and that are more important, quite frankly, than the financial things. You know, staying healthy, you know, is more important.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a tough gig. I don't, and here I am. Why did I even get involved with it? But despite all of that and the ups and downs and the challenges, you know, you do it because you love it. And
it's, yeah.
And you know, the challenges are enjoying, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. I think, it can be really difficult, but it can also be a wonderful, community to be part of, I think. But yes, it can be really, really tough. So yeah. Yeah. Okay. So you talked, about communication and how we need to, talk about the industry more, talk about farming, how we need to communicate with consumers better. And someone who is doing that, locally to you, local teacher called Matt Willer, doing an allotment project. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, Mr. Willer, he is an absolute legend. He is, you talk about great people. You meet Matt and he's just like a big ray of sunshine when you meet him. He's so enthusiastic about what he's doing at our local high school. It's the high school that I went to as a child, and I've got great memories of it, and I've always wanted to be involved with it. So when Matt started his allotment project down there, which is basically it started off as an allotment and for the kids to get involved with, parents to get involved with, growing food and just sustainable food production, I think, is the best way that they would describe it. I mean, I don't want to do them a disservice. I mean, you know, I've been involved with it a little bit, and I take our farming, our manure down there to help them out. But I've just seen from a distance that the positive effect that what Matt is doing is having on the kids down there. So during their lunch breaks, they can go down there and get away from. What's, let's face it, I mean, school is, I think school is stressful for kids these days.
You know, oh, God, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. It was never like that for us, was it?
No, lots and lots of exams from a very early age.
Yeah, and personally, I think that's wrong, but that's another conversation.
Yeah.
So what Matt has done is created this place of learning, you know, about food and food production, but it's also a place where students can go, just have a bit of downtime and, you know, a place for mindfulness and well-being and get rid of some of that stress that I think is quite prevalent in schools now. So for that, I just think, you know, he should be supported and encouraged so much, because it's so important what he's doing to teach children about food, you know, because for me that's where it starts. You know, we've got to start at grassroots level if we want to prosper as food producers, as farmers. We've got to start with the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And Matt is one of the stepping stones in doing that with everything that he's doing at Reefham High School. So yeah, he's just doing great work, Will, and long may it continue. And I think, you know, he's a bright cookie doing great stuff, and he's going to do really well whatever he does, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that's just really good to hear. I mean, there's obviously great things going on with that at the moment, isn't there? Tom Martin, who started FaceTime a Farmer. I mean, I don't know whether you do that, but I signed up to that, and I speak to a school quite regularly down in Kent, and it's just brilliant to talk to them and tell them what's going on the farm. And they ask so many great questions, and they've got a real hunger to learn about farming and food production. I think it's actually, people are probably more interested now than they were 20, 30 years ago. So, yeah, things like that are absolutely fantastic, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And we've just got to feed that hunger. And I think the more that we can get into schools early and help children. I mean, our local school has a careers day, and you know, I was so quick to sign up for that and go in and talk to them about farming, also media studies as well. But just to, you know, you just want to help kids as much as you can, don't you? And
yeah,
get them on the right path. And I think, you know, for an industry where we're struggling with new entrants, we've got to do all that we can to be positive about our industry. And, you know, it's not all doom and gloom, and that we have, like you said, such a fantastic community. And it is a great, great thing to get involved with. So we should be getting that across to kids at an early age.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. Right, Jeremy, it's flown by, so we're going to end this in the traditional way with the five hard-hitting questions.
I'm really just warmed up, Will.
Okay, I've got stuff. I've got to edit this. I've got to put it out in the morning.
I wanted to do all my plugs. We've got great Hereford bulls for sale and things like that, you know. Camping and glamping in Norfolk.
What's the name of your website so people can go to if they want to see these things?
Yeah, it's Eves Hill Farm. Eves Hill Farm website. And, of course, we're all over social media, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Have a look at us and see what a laugh we're having.
Yeah, well, me and the kids and Sarah have never really been over to Norfolk, so we will try.
Get yourselves over here. Seriously, Will.
We will try and come over because we do like a bit of camping. So, we'll try and get over.
You would be more than welcome. We'd love to see you up here.
Love to. Right then, these five questions. Right. What's your all-time favourite song?
Do you know, this is a nightmare for me because I'm not really a musical person. And as my friends will tell you, you know, I feel like I have a good taste in music. Everyone tells me a shocking taste in music. But, you know, I don't know. Lovely Day by Bill Withers, I think, is a great tune.
Oh, that's a really good choice.
But it's upbeat, isn't it?
That's a great choice.
A great way to start the day.
Fantastic. So you'll have travelled around a lot with your previous career, but where's the favourite place you visited?
Well, this is such a tough question. I mean, I've been so fortunate to go to some amazing places, but I really liked Argentina. I was lucky enough to go and have a look around there for a month. So Argentina, India was great. You know, I think you can find something that you can connect with in just about anywhere you go. Yeah. You know, even here, we're so lucky. I mean, I love Scotland. I love Cornwall. Haven't been to Wales yet, though. Just I'm waiting for an invite.
You can come over whenever you like.
Traveling and you know, any trip I feel is a privilege, really, to go and look at other places, meet people and learn about different cultures.
Fantastic. Okay. Who would you most like to have co-hosted a TV series with?
I've laboured over this one for a long time and I was sort of thinking, right, really hot TV presenters. And then I realised that my wife might listen to this. So steer away from that. Do you know what? The funniest thing is, though, it's probably two of my mates, actually, because we think we're the funniest thing ever when we get together.
Yeah.
My mate James Joyce or Pat Barkham, who's a journalist for The Guardian, is just really interesting and fascinating and intelligent guy. I'd love to do some TV work with those guys.
Cool. Okay, if you could go back in time, I'd give your 16-year-old self one piece of advice, what would it be?
Gosh, do you know, probably be a bit more careful with money.
Yeah.
During my time in Paris, that was just dripping through my fingers like water.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, mine might be similar.
Just look after yourself. Be kind to yourself and, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. And lastly then, if you had to recommend a farmer or someone involved in agriculture to follow on social media to a non-farmer, who would it be and why?
Oh, choosing one's difficult, but, you know, I think Farmers of the UK is a great account.
Yeah.
But for non-farming people.
Definitely.
You can learn a lot so quickly. Listen to it in June because I'm going to be on there talking about all things Hereford. Otherwise, your good self, Will, Farmer Tom, Hannah Jackson, there are so many great accounts out there.
Yeah. No, good answers. Des, thank you so much for talking to us tonight. It's been really good to hear all about your journey. I do wish you every success with the new ventures.
Will, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much. It was nice talking to you. I hope I haven't rambled on too much.
No, not at all. And we will try and come over one of these days. It'd be great to see what's going on with you.
Brilliant. All right, Will. Thanks a lot.
Cool. Thanks, Jeremy. And to everyone at home, thanks for listening. I hope to see you next time. I've been Will Evans, this has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.